Two more classic hours with Lynn Marzulli, author of The Alien Interviews, Conversations with People Who Experience UFO Contacts. We'll be back. We'll continue talking about Dr. Jesse Marcel and some other cases. Last hour of the night, we'll take your phone calls with Lynn. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Lynn, let's pick up with Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. before we get to the end of the hour there.
Sure. One thing that just amazed me, and I just want to read this. This is an excerpt from the book, just real quick. Tell us the account of a night your dad brought the debris home. So this is Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr., decades later, recalling what happened when he was around 11 or 12 years old. And he says, I had been asleep for several hours, and my dad came into my bedroom and awakened me. He was very excited and led me into the kitchen where my mother was standing in the corner. On the floor, there was a pre-positioned pieces of metallic foil, beam-like structures, and black plastic fragments like pieces of a broken phonograph record. My dad said, take a close look at this, as you will probably never see anything like this again. I think he used the words like parts of a flying saucer to describe the debris. He first wanted us to look for anything that could have come from a radio, such as vacuum tubes, resistors, or condensers, which there wasn't anything like that. I think he already knew, but wanted my mother and myself to satisfy our curiosity. We looked at the debris for about 15 minutes, then my dad boxed it up and brought it out to the car. And he goes on from there. Fascinating interview. What amazes me is it's just, once again, it's like Ricky Soro. It's just real straight ahead. This is what I saw. He hasn't varied. The story has never been embellished in all the years since he first came forward with it. And this, in some ways, it ties into the whole idea of the government suppressing it. And the people around the town of Roswell, New Mexico in 47, who apparently were threatened not to say anything. And, of course, now decades later, some of these people have finally come forward, deathbed confessions. And again, a skeptic looks at this and goes, well, this is just one man's story. Why should I believe Dr. Jesse Marcel? But strip it down again and look at all the different witnesses that have come forward in the last several years. Talking about this, many deathbed confessions, talking about that I handled something. In fact, History Channel, UFO Hunters did a special on this, and they actually had Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. on the show with this other gentleman who had just recently come forward. He's now deceased, so it's sort of like a deathbed confession. And they were asked to handle different samples of metal to see and determine which one was similar to what you handled. It was a blind test, so Jeff, Dr. Marcel didn't know what the other man had picked and vice versa. And they came and they both picked. They went right to there was like six or seven different pieces of metal out there. They went and they handled all of them, immediately said, no, 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 sort of like it. And they get to this one piece, which is, I think, number five, and they go, this is very close to it. You got something here. So it was, they sort of collaborated the story. The fabric that they picked was, I forget the name of the fabric, but it wasn't around in 1947. So, you know, whatever it was a celluloid type film. Weather balloons didn't have it, and so I mean the whole story of the weather balloon stuff. And there was a gentleman out here that did a lecture at Pepperdine University, and I went to it, and you know he talked about the whole weather balloon thing and Project Mogul, and I stood up and asked a question, and I said, sir, excuse me, but how do you reconcile the fact that the crash test dummies weren't employed till 1952? And he just kind of looked at me, hemmed and hawed, and eventually, to cut to the chase, I just got up and left the lecture.
And he was aware of that. I know he was.
He was. It was like disinformation, and I did some research on this guy. He's an ex-military guy. So
yeah, he didn't expect to have someone like you in the audience.
It was a very interesting conversation. But, you know, look, talking to Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. and getting him to come on the record and hearing the story, I mean, this is the guy. I mean, this is kind of like the Motherlode. This is the guy that handled the wreckage. I mean, he was there. His father has passed away now, and his father never changed the story. I mean, all these years, he never changed his story. And finally, when his father started talking about it, then, of course, you know, the rest is history, Stanton Friedman and the books, and, you know, and we all follow on his heels, so to speak.
Absolutely. It's an incredible case. Matt and Laura, who are they?
I'm sorry, Matt and Laura.
Yeah.
They are two people, again, I get a variety of emails, and I received an email from someone that said, you know, my nephew and his wife, they were driving and they saw a UFO. And I get a lot of these, so you kind of go, okay, great, fine. But I was diligent and I followed up on the email and contacted them and got very interested in the story because it was really a bizarre one, and it was up close and personal. It wasn't like something that was, well, we looked at and we saw this strange light, you know, 15 miles away or something. It was like right in front of their faces. And what happened was they were driving on a freeway in California. It was around midnight, and they look over in this field. This is just a really bizarre story, fascinating interview. And they look over in this field, and there's this diamond-shaped craft, which is doing these acrobatics. It's hovering, right? And it's about, they estimated about the size of let's say, a two-lane freeway. That's about how wide it was, but it was a triangle shape, no noise, and had these just powerful lights, almost like stadium lights. And it would just do these flips. It would just flip like this, like you take your hand, palm down, and then flip it real quick, and your palm's up.
Yeah.
That's what it was doing. I mean, just like, what the heck? And they're looking at this thing, and they're kind of going like, you know, what is this? And as they're driving, the thing starts to move from the field and literally comes straight at them. And, you know, he freaks. I mean, he puts on the brakes. The thing passes literally right over the top of the car and goes to the other side of the road and into another field, an adjacent field, and it starts to perform the same ridiculous acrobatic. I mean, you know, who knows what the thing was doing? And they can't believe what they're seeing. And there's other cars on the road, and here's the weird part. No one else is reacting to this thing. They go down the freeway. They get onto the next exit. They come back around. They see the craft again, you know, and they come back down the road. And the craft is doing exactly the same thing. And what's even more bizarre, you know, and I asked him a whole series of questions. Were there any markings on the craft? Did it make any noise? There were no markings on the craft. It didn't make any noise. It wasn't a stealth fighter. They were agitated. They were in a state of, like, hyper-awareness. Like, you know, like if there's a fire or something or there's an accident, people, the adrenaline starts kicking in and people move into, like, a hyper-awareness. Some people can move into that state of consciousness, and that's what they were in. They were very agitated. They weren't really afraid, but they were agitated. And they said one of the most bizarre aspects of the case, there was a CHP officer down the road who had to have seen what was going on, had to have seen it. I mean, he's looking right at it. And other cars were passing by, and, like, they weren't seeing anything. I mean, it was almost like, for whatever reason, these two people, the cloaking device was off, and for whatever reason, they were able to see this thing. And, you know, it did the same thing. It was doing these ridiculous acrobatics in the field, and then all of a sudden the lights would go off completely, and the lights would come on again. And they, as I said, these things were as bright as a stadium lights. And then the thing flew over the craft, and, I mean, they've never forgotten about it. So it's a very, very riveting interview. I thought it was just really interesting. I had never heard anything like that at all.
What's so great about this and the alien interviews is that the material is so immense. I mean, you could have also, you know, handled that Lonnie Zamora police case or Philip Corso, stories we all know. You're bringing some brand new ones to the table, which I like, Lynn. But again, that tells you that there's so much going on in this field.
No, there is, and it goes back to my original, you know, statement at the top of the first hour. It's like we may disagree as to what the phenomena is, but surely we agree that it is a phenomena, that it's real, it's ongoing, it's burgeoning, and it's not going away. I mean, it just simply is not going away, and that's why when I run into people at the market and I say I'm working on the alien interviews, and they take two steps back, you know, I realize that they're clueless. I mean, what is happening here, these crafts seem to be operating with impunity in our skies. I mean, like, for instance, the Ricky Soro and the people at Stevensville, when they saw the craft disappear, then it came back as being chased by a bunch of F-16s and stuff. I mean, you know, that's operating with impunity. The F-15s, and they said it was like a cat-and-mouse game. The F-15s would kind of close, and this thing would just take off, and you know, a blink of an eye later, and the planes couldn't catch it. And these stories, like we mentioned in the first hour too, that pilot who who was going to fire all 24 of his rockets at that thing, that UFO that was as large as an aircraft carrier or larger, and went away at 10,000 miles an hour. I mean, people are, it's almost like a malaise or stupor, as I said. People really need to wake up and realize that this is the most profound event in all of human history. And when you get, when you start stacking up these witnesses and you start looking at the stories and realizing that, you know, these people are very, I mean, that's why, I mean, just if you look at the list, Dr. Jacobs, Dr. Roger Lear, Dr. Jesse Marcel, retired Major George Fire, Dr. Lynn Cathay. And I deliberately went after those people because they're all highly credentialed and well thought of. I mean, these aren't some, you know, fourth grade educated, you know, hick out and who knows where. I mean, these people have studied the phenomenon and looked at it. And I think when we start to put the pieces together, we realize that this thing is real and it's not going away. And that should cause people to wake up. And that's, of course, why I wrote the book.
Let's talk about George Filer for a moment. What's behind his obsession of these weekly UFO reports?
Well, he says, let me just read this real quick because I think it's kind of a, again, it's interesting. And everybody we've talked to or talked about tonight, it's all hands-on. It's all, you know, they've encountered this thing. They're there. Dr. Roger Lear, you know, picked out the implant. He handled the thing. He saw it move. You know, he's done his research. It's like first person right there in the field. This is the question. You mentioned in the lead in the Weekly Post that you have seen UFOs. Can you elaborate on this? And he writes, I personally became interested in UFOs when I chased one over England when flying for the U.S. Air Force. London Control Radar directed our pursuit, and we picked up the UFO on our radar and saw its lights. I've been investigating them ever since. My experience was, and he continues from there. And the bottom line is, I mean, he saw something. And it goes back to Ricky Sorrell. He saw something, which he doesn't use the words overwhelming, and I'm kind of throwing that. I don't want to speak for him. But it's maybe not overwhelming, but certainly life-changing to the point where now he writes a weekly a paper, or a weekly update, I should say, reporting UFO sightings from all over the world. And he came on the record in my last book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, and he said that there's about, he believes, upwards of 10,000 sightings per year. And let's just do this. Let's say 9,500 of them are weather balloons and flares,
okay? Right?
Or Chinese lanterns. What about the other 500? What
yeah.
about take them all away except for two? I mean, if you have two that are legitimate, we need to start rethinking things and address what's really going on. And of course, in my opinion, and it's Dr. Filer or Major Filer rather, it's a lot more than two. I mean, he thinks that. Most of what people are seeing, and he reports, seem to be the real deal.
Does he ever come across cases that he is so baffled with, he just doesn't understand it, or does he always seem to get to the bottom line?
I think that's a tough question. One of the questions I asked him was, "What's your most prolific or most amazing UFO story?" And he's just kind of flabbergasted. He said, "Well, which one? There's so many of them. In other words, there's so many reports that just I don't want to say that he's overwhelmed by these things, but I mean, there's just so much evidence. This is the guy that collects this stuff on a weekly basis. You know, people are sending reports, and he shows due diligence. He follows stuff down. He checks things out. They've got videos on his site that he." I mean, I get this every week, too. They're just amazing, all the video and people who are seeing this stuff. And let me see, one of the questions I asked him, you know, do you think there's going to be disclosure? And he basically says, I would hope that there was going to be disclosure, but he wouldn't put a date on it. He doesn't think maybe it's sooner than later, like some people believe, like and I do. I believe like it's imminent and very close. I think this thing's gonna pop sooner than later. I don't think we're gonna wait 10 years before.
It may not be this country, but some other country might do that.
Later. Yeah, yeah.
I think so too. Phoenix Lights. So Dr. Lynn Cathay. I think the world of her. She's again. She's somebody who has done a complete investigation into this situation that occurred over 10 years ago, 11 years ago now, 1997. Mm-hmm. Give me your thoughts on her.
Well, I find her just her erudition on the answers was just just amazing. I mean, she's so articulate, and she, of course, talks about her journal, which she kept with this whole adventure that she was on with the Phoenix Lights. I think it was over 600 pages, and at some point she realized that she had to do something about it and share it with the world. But her answers were very, very detailed, and, you know, we got into a whole, it's just pages and pages of question and answers, good Q&A from her. And what amazed me, and I want to tie this into the Ricky Sorrell observation, that one of the witnesses, or several of the witnesses in her documentary DVD, The Phoenix Lights, talked about the same thing when this huge triangular shape or boomerang shape comes flying over, you know, just several hundred feet above where this woman is standing. She describes, in my opinion, a very similar view of the underside of the saucer that Sorrell saw. In other words, she sees the same shimmering type air movement beneath the craft that Ricky Sorrell commented. Like he described it as a almost as a mirage, like the way this thing would shimmer. And she said the same thing, like the air underneath the craft was like shimmering as it moved. And of course, it was noiseless and huge. I mean, there are estimates between a mile and 2 miles wide. And what's interesting about this is, you know, people go with the warthogs and the flares and all this, and there are. And I know I saw you on the Larry King show when that whole Stevensville thing broke, and then they brought in the Phoenix Lights, and they were talking about that also. The idea that remember the two witnesses, I guess, mm-hmm. the two girls that were in high school at the time, and the skeptics going there, "Are you a credible witness?" And they just kind of laughed, which I thought was just so endearing. And they said, "Look, we were there. We wish you were there, because we looked up and we couldn't see the stars, and this thing was enormous, and it was silent, and it was huge, and it took, you know, forever to come over the house." And of course, Dr. Lynn Cotai has spent hours, hundreds of hours, talking to different witnesses. And that's the thing, you know, with the whole idea of flares or some sort of a holograph or whatever, this Phoenixville Lights, this craft, was seen from one part of the state to the other part of the state over a period of several hours. So if somebody wants to create some kind of a hoax or blame it on, you know, the warthogs or whatever dropping flares, that only accounts for a certain segment of a certain period of time of the phenomena. The phenomena went on for hours and was seen by thousands of witnesses. And one of the things, one of the dynamics of the interview, again, ties back into things that we've talked about. The witnesses were very reticent to come forward. And, of course, we see Fife Simonkin dressing up as one of his chief of staff and, you know, running around in the alien suit. And this caused people to, you know, "I don't want to be involved in this. I'm not going to come on the record. I'm not going to say I saw anything. I don't need this ridicule. I don't need to be ostracized or lose my job," or, you know, all the things that people are afraid of. And so now, you know, over a decade later, she made the DVD and gathered up these witnesses, and they did come on the record. One of them, I think, was a police officer, which is just amazing. I mean, here's a guy who is a trained observer, okay? He is a trained observer, and he talks about seeing this craft, how big it was, and overwhelming. I mean, just overwhelming. One of the alarming parts of the interview was when she talked about how some of the witnesses felt euphoric or were just ready to, almost like that Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind scene when they're all, you know,
just leaving, right?
Yeah, just, yeah. You know, beam me up type thing.
Yep, yep.
And I was alarmed by that because, you know, we don't know what we're looking at here. I mean, I think I know what we're looking at, but it's just one scenario, one theory. It's true. It's backed up by research, but I could be wrong. I don't think I am, but I'm certainly not going to open the door to this thing and embrace this without knowing what I'm looking at. And that alarmed me, that some of the witnesses who had seen this had that feeling of euphoria, that they were witnessing something, obviously otherworldly. And this ties back into what Ricky Sorrell says, that same word, overwhelming. And I truly believe that if when this thing happens, George, when the revealing happens, and let's say there's a mile wide or a 2 mile wide craft over Los Angeles, I mean, all bets are off.
And it could happen sooner than later. We'll be back with more. Indeed, with our special guest tonight, Lynn Marzulli, and we'll be back with Lynn in a moment. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, and you can chat with them. We'll be back. Now, you interviewed someone in L.A. by the name of Lynn Dickey, who for a moment, while I was glancing, thought maybe it was that football player from years gone back. But it was not.
Yeah, she's a contactee. Really bizarre stories. She was involved in certain occult practices, which eventually opened her up to these entities. And she, of course, believed at one point that she was contacting, let's say, somebody from the Beta Reticuli or wherever. I mean, you know, the Pleiades, whatever. That's what she believed. And these entities would manifest, and they would communicate with her telepathically, and she would take photographs. In other words, they would tell her, go out and take a photograph of the sky, and she would do that, and when she would develop, these are all digital photographs, by the way,
yeah.
And then she would see a saucer, a craft, and this happened over a period of time, and she eventually got to the point where she realized that when these things began to manifest and communicate with her, and to so she's like an experiencer, a contactee. I mean, different than someone who's been abducted. She was never, as far as I know, never really abducted, but she was in contact with these entities, and oftentimes, and this is an important point, oftentimes she would have this overwhelming feeling of dread and a nausea in her stomach, in her body, which are warning signs, and she wouldn't really heed them, and she kept going on with this thing. And so she finally became sort of sickly, emaciated, lost a lot of weight, and that's when she finally came out of it. And at one point, she talks about where the entity would appear to her in a form that, like a shapeshifter, appear to her in a way that she would sort of accept it. And when she began to back away from it, the thing kind of showed her what it really looked like. And that's when she realized that whatever these things were, they were incredibly malevolent. And that's what she comes on the record, and that's what her story is about. That's a thumbnail sketch of it.
That's a great story. Also, the Travis Short documentary, you've included Travis under Mothman and UFOs. Great mm-hmm. story.
You know, Travis and everybody who, you know, came in on that Lawrence Gray, it's the same thing. It just... the reason why I bring that in, George, is because, again, it's showing us some sort of phenomena that happened in 1966 and 67. Many of the people were met with the typical ridicule, oh, it's just a sandhill crane. You know, the people in West Virginia are stupid. And that's and the townspeople really were taken aback by that.
Of course.
It wasn't a 7-foot sandhill crane that we saw. And these people, when Travis Short comes on the record and talks about interviewing Linda Scarberry, one of the primary witnesses who saw Mothman, this woman's life was basically ruined from this entity. I mean, her marriage, she's divorced. Her marriage ended up, you know, in shambles, and it's been this long, slow decline. And you know, Travis, and I believe it too that you can link this directly to Mothman. Or whatever this entity was, and I hate the name Mothman. I mean, it was just Batman was really popular at the time, and this one reporter just named this apparition Mothman, and so we're stuck with it today, which really does this whatever this thing was a great injustice. And what's interesting, and last time I was on the show, you know, we talked about what Lawrence Gray did and how he was able to overcome the Mothman thing, but this whatever this entity was. And this goes back, again, to the first hour where we were talking about the abduction scenario, how they move, how they create this climate of fear. And Travis Short and Jeff Wamsley, who's written two books on it also, about you know the apparitions and the Mothman entity and all that, he has a quote that basically says that no one who ever saw Mothman came away from it feeling good about the encounter. And so... people were often, when they saw this thing, they were terrified, they were paralyzed. Linda Scarberry and the other woman that she was with the night that they saw this thing, they went to the emergency room and treated for shock, essentially, because they were so overwhelmed, there's that word again, and terrified at what they had seen. So this, of course, ties into my thesis which, you know, we'll get into eventually of what I think we're looking at here. It's all part of the same thing. And you know, some people go, well, what does Mothman have to do with UFOs? In my opinion, everything. When these sightings were going on, as John Keel writes, there were innumerable sightings of craft all over the area. Mm-hmm. And almost something was opened up, something was shaken, and these things were manifesting like crazy. Very interesting.
Alien-human hybrid. You talked with a surgeon, right?
Yeah. Last time I was on, we posted up, you guys posted up a picture that mm-hmm. I had received anonymously in the mail. And, you know, who knew where it was, a hoax or not. And I have a monthly newsletter that I, news magazine that I send out. And I took the picture, put it in the news magazine, sent it out, and said, hey, if anybody comment on this thing. And this one man, who's apparently a, you know, in the middle, I think he's a surgeon, actually, he looked at this thing and weighed in on it. And what was interesting is he ascertained that the picture seemed to be that of some sort of a hybrid creature, but it was in a laboratory setting. In other words, it wasn't in a medical setting. It was in a laboratory setting. And it's just for the people who haven't seen it, it's just it's a man, I presume a man, with gloves on, and he's holding in both of his hands this very small, almost like a fetus type creature, being, entity, whatever. And what was interesting is he weighs in on it and talks about how this whatever this thing is, if it's a puppet or if it's a hoax, it's a very clever one. Someone had to know anatomy, and I just found it absolutely fascinating because he, you know, talks about the way the neck is, the way the double jointedness, the umbilical cord, the way the feet are, the way the hands are. He just gets into this whole thing, how the gloves are not surgical gloves, they're more from a laboratory. Same thing with the dress, appears to be more of a laboratory type setting. And his final comment is that what in his opinion, it doesn't seem to be a hoax. It seems to be the real thing. Other people may disagree. I don't know. But it seems to be some sort of a hybrid. And it definitely, you know, not of this earth. So I thought that was really interesting. Again, one of the 17 that I've interviewed to show us that something is going on. We need to dialogue about it. We need to talk about it. We need to, when people come forward, they need to be accepted and not ridiculed and not scoffed at.
What drives you, Lynn? Why do you keep pushing for this?
Well, what drives me basically is I believe that this is the coming great deception. I believe that from all my reading, look, this is my fifth book on the subject, from the Nephilim Trilogy to Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, to which, you know, the Nephilim Trilogy made me write Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural because a lot of people didn't want to read fiction. And I had all this research, and I said, wow, I need to put this down. So the Strange Bedfellows, and we've talked about this before, you know, the political and the prophetic and how it may kick off the supernatural. Well, that the offspring of that is really the Alien Interviews, because as I was talking about Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, the moment I got to the supernatural part, people would just shut me off. Just shut me off. So much skepticism out there. So the Alien Interviews is really to just open the door, get a lot of different people from different worldviews, different paradigms, get them on the record, find out what they say, and let the reader weigh it in and decide what they want to believe. What drives me, George, is I believe that all this is leading towards something which ancient manuscripts talk about thousands of years old. Which now, of course, we're looking at the debacle in the Middle East, and this is just a precursor of what of the war. And you know, I've written about this, the whole prophecy thing, Ezekiel 38. Mm-hmm. We don't need to get into that tonight, but I believe that prophecy has never been fulfilled, and it will be fulfilled at some point. It also begs the question that with this current war that's going on over there, why hasn't Hezbollah gone forward again? Why hasn't Iran? And since the last time I was on the show, the Russian bear has awakened and went into Georgia and is also backing Iran and Hezbollah and Libya. I mean, these exact nations are the nations that are listed in the prophecy, and we see them beginning to form this loose confederacy, this loose coalition, which ties back into the prophecy. I believe, George, that when they reveal themselves, and I think it'll be sooner or later, This will kick off what I've termed the coming Great Deception. This is the Great Deception. They will say that they were our progenitors. They will say that they created us. They will say that we're here to usher you into a higher consciousness. That whole thing that we started all the world's religions. That Jesus and Buddha and Krishna and Muhammad right. were just there. That we genetically manipulated them and endowed them with certain abilities and mm-hmm. all the miracles.
Powers.
That whole deal.
Yeah, and we do this all around the universe.
Yeah, this is what we do.
Yeah. Shroud of Turin. Very strange tie-in here. Tell me about this one.
Well, it is a strange tie-in. In fact, recently on the Discovery Channel, there was a. They finally came out with a program, New Evidence for the Shroud of Turin. And what it talked about, which finally the information's out there for the public to take a look at it and understand what the Shroud of Turin actually, I believe, and we've talked about this before, is I believe it's God's calling card. I believe that this thing is the real deal. And it speaks of it, and this is the whole the reason why I brought the Shroud of Turin is because it speaks of another physics that we know nothing about. The Shroud of Turin, the image on the Shroud of Turin, and if people don't know about it, I suggest you get the book because it's a fascinating article by Dr. Wanger, but you can Google it and find out all sorts of information on it. The image on the Shroud is not paint. There's no paint. There's no brush strokes. There's no directionality. It's random. The pixels are so small. Let me just read you something real quick. Image information resides only on the top of the fibrils. Fibrils are like one little thread, so the top of that make up the shroud threads, and the contrast of the image information decreases as it descends down around the sides of the fibrils, terminating at the exact side 90 degrees from top center. That's a lot to digest. Basically, to paraphrase it, the image is so faint, it's only on the very topmost of the fibril and then abruptly shuts off at 90 degrees. This, in my opinion, the Shroud of Turin and the new evidence basically that they realized that the carbon dating was skewed, and this is why it was skewed. The carbon dating was taken from a piece of the shroud which was damaged in the fire, okay, in the 15th century.
Mm-hmm.
They have recently discovered that what they did. The Poor Sisters of Clare actually created end-to-end splices. I mean, this is just off the charts. End-to-end splices in the shroud that are almost you really can't see them with the naked eye. But if you magnify it, you can. And so, guess where they took the samples to carbon dated? Literally right from the repair spot. But that's just yeah. one element of the shroud. A physicist came on the record. Her name is Dame Pixick, and she works, I think, at Edinburgh University. She's also an art historian, and her murals are displayed in museums all throughout the world. So she brings a really unique dynamic, and she examined the shroud. And one thing she talks about is the event horizon of the shroud. In other words, if you were going to paint this on, there has to be some sort of an outline. There's no outline on the shroud. When she looked at this thing, she proposed that the body, this is how she believes it happened, that the body was levitated off the slab of stone, that the shroud somehow was pulled perfectly taut, and the body dematerialized instantaneously at millions of points of light, instantaneously. And that's what created the image on the shroud.
God, I know. I've always been a believer in this. It's a calling card.
That's what I call it. I believe it's God's calling card. Yeah. And see what this speaks of, and here's where I'm going with this whole UFO thing. What it speaks of is a dimension that we know nothing about. Let me explain.
Okay.
We're imbued with five senses, okay? We have our intellect, and we move through this three-dimensional space-time continuum, and we're constrained by time and space, and we only have our senses, and we process data by what we see, by what we hear, taste, smell, and we process these things, and we have an intellect, and we have a memory, and somehow we interface with all this stuff, and we can use it for good things, like, let's say, the Salk vaccine or whatever, or finding a cure for cancer, or we can use this information that we do and our senses that we're imbued with, that are inherent in us, for horrible things. Like thinking of Hitler or Pol Pot, or, you know, take your pick.
Mm-hmm.
The heinous acts that have happened over history. These attributes that human beings have are inherent to us. We all have them. Knowing that, let's take a look at some of the so-called angelic beings. Get a swig of water.
Sure.
Some of these angelic beings that manifest through the centuries to different people. One of them I find really interesting. This guy Peter is in a prison cell. Okay, he's in a jail cell. This angel manifests in front of Peter. Instantly, Peter kind of goes. He's not sure whether he's dreaming or he's awake. He's not sure. His mind is being fooled with on some level. He's not thinking clearly. The angel tells him to get up. Peter's chained. All of a sudden, chains drop off. The angel doesn't do anything. Chains just drop off. The next thing is he notices that all the guards are asleep. That shouldn't be. The prison door opens by itself. They walk out of a jail cell, down the corridor. All the guards are asleep. They get into the courtyard. The huge gate that separates, you know, the whole prison complex opens without anyone touching it. They walk through, and then the angel slips back into this other dimension and is gone. There are countless stories of this. When these guys appear, what happens to these people, everybody, all across the board, people usually fall on their faces. I mean, when they actually manifest, they are totally afraid. The difference is, and what we're looking at, you know, in those things that I just talked about, to us, we would look at that and go, oh, my gosh, that's miraculous. How did the chain fall off? How did the prison gate open up? How did the larger gate open up? How did he get the guards asleep? And to us, all that is very supernatural, of course, and seems like it's a miracle. I would propose that this being is just moving in ways that are common to him and common to all the angelic hosts. They're imbued with these particular properties, and they can just do these things. It's normal for them. But when they manifest in our dimension, it becomes supernatural. It becomes abnormal. It becomes overwhelming. Now, the good guys, apparently, when they appear, they always say things like, peace be with you. Or they'll come up to you, and if you're on your face on the ground trembling, they'll come up and go, don't be afraid. And they pick you up and they touch you and somehow restore you in that process. Okay, the bad guys don't do that. The bad guys, for instance, when the Mothman appeared to Lawrence Gray, it just sat there in front of him, and Lawrence Gray said it was wickedness. That's the word he uses.
Wickedness.
It was wickedness that manifested. And finally, Lawrence Gray was able to overcome this thing by saying, back to the blood of Jesus again, but that's what he said. And the thing dissipated, which meant that he's using some sort of a name or some sort of a spiritual dynamic that he believes in, which seemed to overcome the entity, which ties back into Joe Jordan, which we talked about in the first hour, of evoking a name of Jesus and stopping the abductions. These creatures, these entities, and when you go back and look at all the things that we've talked about, there's an element of fear and uncertainty. Dr. Jacobs has a feeling of fear for his children, because of the breeding program and where this thing is going. When you talk to Karina Sable, she sits there, she's on a table, and she's absolutely terrified. She wants to scream, but she can't. And on, like Ricky Sorrells, he's overwhelmed by what he sees. And so the bad guys, in my opinion, because apparently there was some sort of a war. We don't know much about it. Even the ancient manuscripts really don't point and give us a whole description, but we know that there was some sort of a war, some sort of a division, which seems to be ongoing. And some of these angelic beings are just incredibly evil, but it doesn't change the properties and their what they've been imbued with. It doesn't change who they are. And just like Hitler is a bad guy, and just pick somebody who's a real good guy, let's say, they're still human beings, but one chooses to do evil and the other one chooses to do good. Same thing with these angelic beings. So what I think is manifesting is exactly what the ancient manuscripts talk about and tell us about, is the idea of fallen angels. Here's one more thing to think about.
All right, let's do it right at the top. We'll be back.